Jaika Satpala Sarva Siddhanta Ratnatya Sarva Lokaika Drikpada Sarva Bhagavata Prana Srimad Bhagavata Prabhu Kalidvanto Ditaditya Sri Krishna Parivartita Paramananda Pattaya Prema Varshakshadayate Sarvada Sarva Sevyaya Sri Krishnaya Namostu Me Madhika Bandho Matsangin Madguru Madmahadana Manistaraka Madbhagya Madananda Namostu Te Asadu Sadhu Tadayin Ati Nichochata Para Anamuncha kadachin mam premnarit kantayokspura. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Okay, we have five verses in a row. We'll chant together the first one. The last one. Okay, so I got it. I'll chant the first for myself. Kvachit pibantiyam pibati Moriram madavihvalaha Ashnantiyam kvachit ashnati Jakshatyam saha jakshiti Kvachit gayati gayantiyam Rurantiyam rurati kvachit Kvachit dasantiyam hasati Jalpantiyam anujalpati Quachid davati davantiam tishtantiam anutishtati anushete shayanayam anvaste quachid asatim quachid trinoti shvinvantiam pashyantiam anupashyati quachid jigrati jigrantiam Sprishantyam sprishati kvachit. Okay, together. Kvachit cha shochatim jayam. Anushochati dinovat. Anurishyati vishyantyam. Muditam anumodate. Quachit cha shochatim jayam Anushochati dinavat Anuhrishyati vishyantyam Muditam anumodate Kvachit cha shochatim jayam Anushochati dinavat Anuvishyati vishyantyam Muditam anumodate Kvachit cha shochatim jayam Anushochati dinavat Anuvishyati vishyantyam Muditam anumodate Kvachicca shochatim jayam Anushochati dinavat Anuvishyati vishyantyam Modita manu modite. Ladies.
Kvachitcha shochatim jayam.
Anushochati dinavad. Anurishyati vishyantyam. Vitamanu modate. Kvachitcha shochatim jayam. Anushochati dinavad. Anurishyati vishyantyam. Word for word goes on for almost a whole page. I'm going to skip it, and we'll go to the translation. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. When the queen drank liquor, King Paranjana also engaged in drinking. When the queen dined, he used to dine with her. And when she chewed, King Paranjana used to chew along with her. When the queen sang, he also sang. Similarly, when the queen cried, he also cried. And when the queen laughed, he also laughed. When the queen talked loosely, he also talked loosely. And when the queen walked, the king walked behind her. When the queen would stand still, the king would also stand still. And when the queen would lie down in bed, he would also follow and lie down with her. When the queen sat, he would also sit. And when the queen heard something, he would follow her to hear the same thing. When the queen saw something, the king would also look at it. And when the queen smelled something, the king would follow her to smell the same thing. When the queen touched something, the king would also touch it. And when the dear queen was lamenting, the poor king also had to follow her in lamentation. In the same way, when the queen felt enjoyment, he also enjoyed. And when the queen was satisfied, the king also felt satisfaction. Purport. The mind is the place where the self is situated. And the mind is conducted by the intelligence. The living entity situated within the heart follows the intelligence. The intelligence is herein depicted as the queen. And the soul, under mental control, follows the material intelligence just as the king follows his wife. The conclusion is that material intelligence is the cause of bondage for the living entity. The point is that one has to take the spiritual intelligence to come out of this entanglement. In the life of Maharaj Ambarisha, we find that the great Maharaj first engaged, this is someone else, this is not Paranjana, this is Ambarish, just the opposite number. In the life of Maharaj Ambarisha, we find that the great Maharaj first engaged his mind on the lotus feet of Krishna. In this way, his intelligence became purified. Maharaj Ambarish also used his other senses in the service of the Lord. He engaged his eyes in seeing the deity in the temple nicely decorated with flowers. He engaged his sense of smell by smelling the flowers. And he engaged his legs by walking to the temple. His hands were engaged in cleansing the temple, and his ears were engaged in hearing about Krishna. His tongue was engaged in two ways, in speaking about Krishna and in tasting prasad offered to the deity. Materialistic persons who are under the full control of material intelligence cannot perform all these activities. Thus, consciously or unconsciously, they became entangled by the dictations of material intelligence. This fact is summarized in the following verse. So, who would you vote for as the leader of your government Puranjana or Ambarisha. Take your choice. But we may be thinking, this Ambarish, Puranjana, he's a fool. He's just a jerk. You know, why is he like this? But we don't realize that's us. Ambarish is every man. He's every conditioned soul. Puranjana, oh boy. Puranjana, yeah, oh boy. Okay, excuse me for that. Puranjana is every man. In medieval Europe, they used to have public entertainment called morality plays. You know, religious instruction in the form of drama. We should do that too. We used to do it out in the streets. And there was the most popular play was the play of every man. Basically, King Puranjana. Every soul is falling into the same trap. We're all creatures of habit. We have our conditioning. Even as practicing devotees, we're struggling. Especially as practicing devotees, we're struggling with our conditioning. Fortunately, there's an end to it. We're practicing sadhana bhakti. And it has a purpose. It's not just an end to itself. You know, we get into a material rat race. We work just to make money, and we use the money just to pay our debts, and then we have to work more because we get further in debt, and we just go on and on until we die. But our life is different. There's an end in sight. There's a goal. We don't just perform sadhana bhakti because we're caught in a rat race, the rat race of sadhana bhakti. You know, get up and chant 16 rounds, do some work, then you got to go to sleep and get up again and do it again. It's not just like that and then go on until you drop dead. There's a goal to it, of course. If you're not sure what it is, look at Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu. Rupa Goswami explains it all. What is the purpose of sadhana bhakti? Because our acharyas are not interested just in rules and regulations. That's not what they do in the spiritual world. Follow all sorts of rules and regulations and practice austerities. No, that's not the style of life in the spiritual realm where people do what they want to do. In the spiritual world, it's all enjoyment. It's the pleasure of having your relationship with Krishna and his devotees and doing things to please Krishna and to please his devotees. And it's spontaneous. Love is spontaneous in the spiritual world. And even in the material world, if someone can develop that pure Krishna consciousness, even in the midst of the material energy, he's also enjoying. Certainly the Supreme Lord is always enjoying. No matter what, we may think that Krishna, when he got married to 16,000 queens, that they controlled him like Puranjana was controlled by his wife. But that is a serious delusion. To think that Krishna is dominated by his wives. Puranjana just had one material intelligence, one wife. But Krishna had 16,108 wives. But he wasn't dominated by them at all. Etad ishanam ishasya prakriti sto pi tadgunai nayujyate sadatma stair tata buddhis yata buddhis tadashraya. This is what makes God God. Not just that he owns everything and he can destroy the universe or create another universe whenever he wants. Okay, that God has those qualities, but what's the essence? What makes God God? Different than everybody else. Even a yogi can get the power to create a world or to destroy a world. But what makes God unique? Lord Brahma is controlling the whole universe. He created it, and he's just a jiva. He's not God. So what's different about God? This is the godliness of God. This is what makes God different. Prakriti sto, pi, even though he's in the midst of his material energies, he's not influenced by them. He can be in the middle of Maya and not be affected. That's God. And not only God, tata buddhis tadashraya. Similarly, the intelligence of a devotee who has taken full shelter of Krishna is similarly not affected, even in the middle of illusion. Everyone else is deluded, and there are all the allurements of Maya surrounding him. Still, he's not affected. A pure devotee. And the word is buddhi. Buddhis tadashraya. It's the intelligence that will keep us in Krishna consciousness or drag us into illusion. Just as Paranjana is being dragged into illusion by his intelligence, from the minute he married his wife, or married his intelligence, accepted his material condition, he was dragged down into illusion and confusion and suffering. Remember that intelligence is the function of the subtle body that directs our attention in definite ways. The intelligence doubts. The mind doesn't doubt. The mind is simply attracted, like a dog doesn't discriminate in his eating. If you give him a lot of food, attractive food, he'll eat it until he dies from overeating. He won't stop. He has no discrimination. Like that, the mind will just go after whatever it's attracted to without discrimination. But the intelligence, the higher function of the subtle body, discriminates. It decides what is desirable and what is undesirable and fixes the mind. With intelligence, we make up the mind. We settle the mind and direct ourselves in particular to particular goals, any kind of goal. But there are different qualities of intelligence. There is material intelligence, and you can analyze material intelligence in the different modes of nature. Ignorant intelligence, good intelligence, passionate intelligence, and mixtures of them. And Paranjana, this story is being told to another king, Prachini Barhishat. And he's the everyman, the Paranjana, who Narada is trying to save. Of course, Narada is trying to preach to us, but his immediate assignment is to try to deliver King Prachini Barhishat. And he's telling the king this story. Because if he simply told the king directly, "You're a complete fool. You're a slave to your intelligence," the king might not accept it. He wasn't so. King Prachini Barhishat was quite entangled in material affairs. And therefore, Narada decided not to try to preach too directly to him. So he told a story supposedly about somebody else, about this Paranjana, who's actually everybody, and it's particularly King Prachini Barhishat. In the end, he finally tells in the end, Narada says, "This is actually you I'm talking about, and you better change your ways." But in the beginning, he just tells it as a story. So, slave to his material intelligence. Whatever the intelligence decides, he follows. Whereas there's spiritual intelligence. And Prabhupada in the purport gives the example of King Ambarisha, a very great devotee. But he's a very suitable example for us to emulate because he was practicing. Although he was already on the level of love of God, he was practicing the regulated services of bhakti yoga. Yad yad acharati shreshtas tadad evetaro janaha. So whatever a great devotee, a great king like Ambarish does, people will follow. His citizens followed his example. And when we read about this ancient history of such a great king, Ambarish, we want to also follow him. So, loka sangrahartam, for the sake of helping people in general. A person who doesn't need even to follow the rules and regulations does it anyway, to set an example for others. And all these activities that Ambarish did are not beyond the capacity of practically any human being. Any of us, anybody can do these things. They're not superhuman. They're not great heroic deeds that only special people can perform. Engage your mind on the lotus feet of Krishna. Give Krishna a few thoughts. What's the great, traumatic, difficult deed in that? What's so difficult about thinking about Krishna a little bit, at least? What's so difficult about using your feet to walk to Krishna's temple? Or your eyes and looking at the deity? Or the your sense of smell and smelling the flowers and incense offered to Krishna? And what's so difficult about lifting the prasadam and putting it into your mouth? These are not, very severe, difficult activities. Anybody can do these. And can also, by engaging very vigorously and constantly in any or all of these activities of sadhana bhakti, we can free ourselves from the danger of being deluded by material intelligence. Just by eating prasadam, even just chanting Hare Krishna and offering your food to Krishna. If someone comes to you and asks, what do I have to do to become one of you, Hare Krishnas? Don't make it complicated, your answer. Just tell them, chant Krishna's names and offer your food to Krishna. That's all someone needs to do to become a proper Vaishnava. Everything else is details. And those details will be filled in gradually. You'll be given guidance. But to start the process, just chant Hare Krishna and offer everything you eat to Krishna. And doing even only those two things, your intelligence will be protected from, or your intelligence will become spiritualized. Basic point is that attachment cannot be avoided. The mind and intelligence are working in the dynamics of attachment and repulsion and sometimes indifference. These are necessary functions to live. We use our array of input senses, the knowledge-acquiring senses, and they give us so much information about what's going around us in the world, what's happening around us. We need this to live. If we were in complete darkness, completely out of touch, we had no eyes, we had no ears, we had no senses, then even though we were in the world, we could not do anything in the world. We could have no relationships with anything or anybody without having, first of all, knowledge-acquiring senses to give us the contact with the outside world. This is necessary for life. But the senses are giving, there are different senses, and they're quite active. Even one sense, the sight, there's so many things for me to see in this room. I'm supposed to give the class. To do that, I have to look and read the purport. I have to focus my eyes on the page. But also, there's a fly on the wall up there. I might be attracted to look at the fly, or this deity's on the altar, or such and such person is sitting over there, a curious sight. So many things to look at. If I don't have a mind, if I just have senses, they are uncontrollable. The mind is required. The mind has the function of becoming attracted, repelled, or indifferent to the various possible objects of perception. The mind chooses what to perceive. But the mind is fickle. Its choice can change from one moment to the next. I'm supposedly giving a class, but I may start daydreaming or I may start looking at the flies on the wall and lose my attention. That happens easily. So the mind needs help. Therefore, the intelligence performs the function of directing the mind. It's like in India, if you want a job done, like you want some people to lay some bricks, you hire the crew, and then there's a supervisor who just sits there and does nothing but watches that the workers don't goof off, don't go to sleep or walk away. His job is just to supervise and make sure that the laborers who, if they weren't watched, wouldn't do any work, he makes sure that they do some work. So we need a supervisor for our mind who makes sure that the mind sticks to its business and doesn't just wander off to something else. That's the intelligence, who tells the mind, you know, you're being paid to lay the bricks. You know, it's not time to take a nap. So that's the function of intelligence, to tell the mind where to go and where to stay. That is required. Even for ordinary materialistic life, you have to have a mind and an intelligence. If you want to function as a human being, or even as an animal, animals need their intelligence. Where to find the food, how to avoid the predators. Even the lower animals have some kind of rudimentary mind and intelligence. So this is actually a gift of God, that we're given these functions. But animals have the proper use of intelligence and mind, but human beings are meant to do something more. Labdva sudulabhamidam bahusambhavante. What is that to go? Anyway, after attaining... What's the second line of that verse? Labdva sudulabhamidam bahusambhavante. And it says that, anyway, after many lifetimes being various animals and plants in all different species of life, we get then finally the opportunity to be in a human body. Human body has highly developed mind and intelligence, much more than even the monkeys and the horses and the cows and elephants and the porpoises. They have relatively good intelligence and mind. But human mind and intelligence is much better than even the other simians, the other monkeys. And we can use that intelligence. Turanam yateta. We can very vigorously use the mind and intelligence, the human mind and intelligence, to perfect our lives, to get out of this entanglement and go back to Krishna, to regain our spiritual intelligence. And it's a very simple process. Just do the things that Ambarish did. Hear Krishna's names, chant them, and put prasadam in your mouth. And don't put other things in your mouth. That's the basic process. That purifies the intelligence. That transforms the intelligence and brings it back to its original spiritual condition. When is the class supposed to go on to?
Quarter after.
Okay. Well, anyway, we should bear in mind that the story is about us. Even though we're supposedly transcendental, we're practicing devotional service, but we're practicing. We're still trying to learn to give up our attachment. I was talking about there's a goal. I hope we're all clear on what the goal is of sadhana bhakti. Bhava Janmani, to awaken loving attraction to Krishna. That is the purpose of all of our devotional practice. Remember that. Don't forget it. Otherwise, you'll start considering your regulated activities of bhakti a burden, and you'll just give them up eventually. If you don't remember what the goal is, to awaken love of Krishna in the heart. When that love is awakened, then all desires are fulfilled. You have to have, at least in the beginning, this Shraddha. Shraddha, Shabde, Vishwash Kohe, Shudrida Nishchoy. Krishna Karma Koili Sarva Kardiya Krito Hoy. The faith that we're talking about is conviction. Being convinced that if you simply work for Krishna's glorification and Krishna's pleasure, then everything you need and everything you want will come to you. Do we have that conviction? If so, why are we striving for other things? Why aren't we trusting Krishna fully? Why are we trying by other means that are irrelevant or even opposed to devotional service to find the fulfillment of our desires and needs? Why don't we just trust Krishna to provide everything? That is Shraddha. And that is the beginning of the practice of pure devotional service. We're practicing to cultivate that trust in Krishna. And also, at the same time, convincing Krishna that he can trust us by doing some practical service and showing ourselves to be reliable. That way we develop a relationship with Krishna. And when you get close enough to Krishna, you can't help but being very attracted to him. And eventually, bhava, loving feelings, develop in the heart, real love. Bhava is defined as the like the sun just peeking over the horizon, the first rays of the sun. So the first rays of prema, the first inkling of a small taste of pure love of God, that is called bhava. So to get that bhava, to get even one drop of the ocean of the nectar ocean of bhakti rasa, that is the purpose of all of our activities, all our devotional activities. Whatever we're doing, remember, don't forget that that's why we're doing it, to awaken this attraction to Krishna. When you get even one drop, then all your problems are finished. This is Rupa Goswami's declaration in the beginning of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. This is why he called the book by that name. The ocean of the nectar of devotional service. Prabhupada shortened it in his summary study to just nectar of devotion. But the original image is ocean of nectar. And that is in comparison to other kinds of pleasure. Materialistic pleasure is off the chart. We can't even measure it in comparison. It's so meager. But we might compare impersonal liberation to the pleasure of devotional service. And the comparison is that the pleasure of Brahmananda, of merging into the Supreme, is like the small amount of water that's contained in a calf's hoofprint. Here in Los Angeles, you don't see calves on the street. It's maybe illegal to have a calf in Los Angeles. I don't know. But you can imagine, even if you haven't seen one for a while, a calf's hoofprint. It's quite small. In the rainy season, it can get filled with water. Or the way they have sewage in India, they just dump the sewage in the street, and so the calves' hoofprints get filled with, if not rainwater, with sewage. And it's a small amount of water. It's not a great problem to cross a calf's hoofprint. You can step over it without even thinking. It just contains a few ounces of water. It's not much. And that's how much pleasure you get from Brahmananda. Of course, you can say, no, Brahmananda is infinite bliss. You know, I know someone who experiences it. He told me about it. But we're talking relative. How you think that your pleasure from sex and intoxication is great, and you don't want to give it up. And the impersonalist also has his fix. He thinks his pleasure of Brahmananda is the greatest thing. But let's do a real comparison. Your Brahmananda is like that few ounces of water compared to the whole ocean of water. I'm going to fly over the Pacific Ocean tonight. It's almost halfway around the world. That's a lot of water. Compare that to a few ounces of water. Billions, trillions of times greater. That is the pleasure, the comparison of impersonal, the pleasure of impersonal liberation to the pleasure of the ocean of devotion. One drop of it is enough to cure you of all material confusion. If you have Rupa Goswami's declaration, is that if you have tasted even one drop of that ocean, which is basically what you experience on the level of bhava, the first drops of that rasa, or something resembling the rasa, coming close to the rasa, the first drops of real attraction to Krishna, just one drop of that ocean. Once one has tasted that, he cannot be attracted to anything material again, at all. Once you've tasted one drop of the ocean of the nectar of devotion. But, logically, the converse of that is, if you're still experiencing any material attraction or repulsion, if you're ever getting angry, if you're ever, your senses are ever getting agitated, it means you haven't yet tasted one drop of that ocean. Not to be disappointed. That's what we're working for. It may take time and effort, but we're working to get one drop of that ocean. And that will rid us of all attraction to anything material. If that's what we want. If that's what we want. That's what we're working for in this practice of devotional service. Okay, it's already a quarter after. Do we have any time for a few questions? Okay. Archie Tipu? From internet. It's funny, I saw a sign, you know, the list of requests for the repair, for the maintenance. And one was that the ladies ashram, the internet's still down. I remember when we were here, we didn't have any internet. I don't think we had a ladies ashram even.
Hare Krishna. So there's a young man named Matthew who says, yes. I have a mental illness. Sometimes it is hard for my mind to chant. What would be the best solution to help my mind and progress in spiritual life?
I'm sorry. Devotee saying has a mental illness?
It's a young man. Yeah, he said his name is Matthew. He said, I have a mental illness. Sometimes it is hard for my mind to chant. In other words, he's trying to chant.
Okay.
What would be the best solution to help my mind and progress in spiritual life?
Okay, someone who has real difficulty with his mind. His mind is really troubled. Or in general, someone who is strongly influenced by the mode of ignorance in various ways. It's difficult for a person influenced by the mode of ignorance, and insanity is one, you know, strong manifestation of the influence of the mode of ignorance. It becomes difficult when you're strongly influenced by tamogun to practice sadhana bhakti. For some, it's impossible. Even if they want to, it's just too difficult. But the best hope is to not too much worry about the subtle processes, remembering Krishna, or even chanting with great attention, but just be very busy. The best way to control the uncontrolled mind is to work very hard. Use your physical body and work hard for Krishna. That will begin to bring the mind under control. So a person who can't control his mind should work very hard for Krishna. You know, and that will help. And eventually, you'll be able to, you know, that person will be able to chant nicely and even remember Krishna eventually. Mode of ignorance is not incurable, but it's difficult. Okay. I don't know. Anything else? Okay. Yes, Prabhu. Actually, you had your hand first.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I've heard of something of what you're talking about in other religions. It seems...
Oh, it's basic. It's basic. Yeah, it's basic. Understood by other religions also. Yes.
In Buddhism, they call it the Satori experience, and they all of them have some kind of, it's kind of like an orgasmic experience, you could call what you're referring to a drop of the nectar of the ocean.
No, but we're making the point. Someone can disagree. I'll go ahead and finish the question.
And it would be so overwhelming and pleasurable that it would just be beyond anything that we could experience
right
here. It would be going to the source of pleasure, right, basically. And I think that's what you're referring to. It's kind of a mystical experience that could take just a few seconds, and that would be all it would need to take, and that would be it.
So all the religions are advertising that we have it. We have the real experience. Almost every religion. I don't think a religion would be very popular if they say, well, we don't have much to offer you. We can't offer you a better experience. You're just going to experience what you're experiencing now or something worse. Then who's going to want to follow that religion? So for a religion to sell itself, it's got to offer that we're going to, you know, give you a better experience, a better life. I hope, you know, that otherwise why would anybody want to take the trouble of the following a religion unless it's going to give you something better than what you have? So every religion is advertising. They have to survive or to function as a religion trying to attract people. Some religions don't try to attract anybody, but those religions that want people to join it are going to have to advertise that we can give you this blissful experience, spiritual experience. But just, okay, example. I was with Dravida Prabhu in San Diego, and he wanted to, you know, he thought because of my bad breathing, I should have a new air purifier. So he, as a gift, he arranged to get me one. And he looked, which brands are better, and he looked very carefully. So all the companies that make these machines, air purifiers, are advertising that theirs is the best, or theirs does a very good job. But, you know, advertising sometimes is not completely honest, or it doesn't reveal everything. So you can go to the website of the Environmental Protection Agency, and they have objective tests that they've done of the different brands, and you can find out the government rating of which machines work better than others. What's required in such a case is some objective comparison. Everyone's advertising, but who's got the better product? Yeah, some higher authority like the EPA can make an objective judgment. Whereas the people who are selling the product are not going to give you an objective viewpoint. So what I was talking about in the class was such an objective comparison. The comparison between impersonal bliss, the bliss of merging, and the bliss of staying an individual and reciprocating with the supreme person, remaining a person, or refining, purifying your personality and developing a personal relationship with the supreme person. Our finding is that pleasure is relatively much, much greater, billions of trillions of times greater than the pleasure of impersonal merging. Anyway, that's the claim, at least, of Srila Rupa Goswami. And we accept Srila Rupa Goswami as authority, just like people in this country accept the Environmental Protection Agency as an authority on what's good for you and what isn't. It's a comparative thing, an attempt at an objective comparison of which claim is more valid. Okay.
Here in a purport, Srila Prabhupada said the mind is the place where the self is situated.
And mind is the place where the self is situated.
What does it mean, this self, actually?
I'm sorry?
My question is, what does it mean, self? Because the next sentence is explained, living entity situated within the heart. So what does it mean, this self, in a mind?
What is what?
The mind is the place where the self
is
situated.
Where is the mind?
What does it mean, self?
The mind is part of the subtle body.
No, but what does it mean, self? Self is situated in the mind.
The soul, you.
Yeah, but it's explained, living entity is situated within the heart.
Yeah, but the mind, as part of the whole package of the subtle body, mind, intelligence, and ego don't separate. They stay together. They comprise the subtle body. And the subtle body doesn't split up. So the subtle body can be located in different parts of the physical body. The heart, or the anahata chakra here, is where it normally is. It can move up and down to the different chakras. But normally, in normal consciousness, normal condition, the subtle body is more or less located in the region of the heart. And almost always the soul, at least actually it has to be like this, the soul is encaged within the subtle body until he's liberated. As long as he has material existence, he's surrounded by the shell, the M&Ms, you know, surrounded by a candy shell. So we're surrounded by the subtle body. We can't even take it off. It's like a straitjacket. You know, they tie it, in the back so you can't take it off. So we're in the straitjacket of the subtle body. Wherever it goes, we go with it. And the subtle body normally stays in the region of the heart. So if the subtle body is in the heart, then the self is also in the heart. Nope, same, it fits together. Does that answer it?
You just said the subtle body is in a heart, but here it's explained that mind is the place where the self is situated.
Yeah, because the self in material life is surrounded by his subtle body. The mind is part of that subtle body. So yes, we're where the mind is, because we're where the subtle body is. Okay?
Yeah, I understand. Okay.
And the subtle body is in the heart, so we're in the heart also. They're both, there's no contradiction. Yeah, please go ahead.
I just had one.
Please.
When you said, basically, something came to mind when you were talking, and it was from the Bible, seek first the kingdom of God and all things shall be added to you.
Yes.
That's basically what you're...
Yes.
Just trust in Krishna or God.
Yes, trust in God.
That everything else will come.
Yeah, and it even says it here.
Yeah.
In God we trust. Yeah.
including the material.
Yeah. In God we trust. Yeah. You can say it, you can print it on your bills, but do you really believe it?
Yeah.
That if you really believe it, then you're in good shape. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.